The headlines. Iran says U.S. presence in Syria is aimed at plundering the Arab country's oil, as well as expanding Daesh terror cells in the region. The U.K. becomes the first Western country to start vaccinating its general population amid a global attempt to contain the coronavirus pandemic. And an inquiry into last year's mosque attack in New Zealand blames authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community regarding escalating hate crimes. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president says that Tehran and Damascus pursues the common goal of countering Israeli occupiers and fighting terrorism. Hassan Rouhani told the visiting Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad that Iran regards Syria as a strategic ally and will continue to stand by the Syrian people and government until final victory. President Rouhani then touched upon U.S. President Donald Trump's move to cede part of Syrian soil to the Israeli regime. He said fight against Tel Aviv should go on until occupied territories, including Syria's Golan Heights, are liberated. The top Syrian diplomat also sat down with the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Vice Admiral Ali Shamkhani. In the meeting, the Iranian official said that the U.S. seeks to reinforce and expand terror cells of Daesh in the region, loot Syria's oil, and ensure the security of Israel. He said the U.S. presence in the region must end. European Union foreign ministers have adopted a plan aimed at making the 27-nation bloc less dependent on the U.S., the United Kingdom, and China. The ministers argued that the chaotic presidency of Donald Trump has highlighted the necessity for such a move. Jerome Hughes has more.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Britain has begun mass vaccination against coronavirus, becoming the first Western country to do so. A 90-year-old grandmother has become the first person to receive the Pfizer vaccine a week after Britain approved this use. The country plans to vaccinate 2 million people at the end of the year and more in 2021. First in line for the vaccination are the most vulnerable people, as well as frontline health and social care workers. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the vaccination campaign is a huge step forward in the UK's fight against COVID-19. The country is one of the worst hit nations by the virus in the world. It has over 61,000 deaths out of more than 1.6 million infections. Said Puzar is our correspondent joining us from London. Tell us about this rollout, and in particular, if we can anticipate at some point, if you have that information, as to whether the people that are getting the vaccine, what can be expected in terms of positive outcomes from it?
Good to be with you, Kaveh. Just like you said, they have rolled out this vaccine. They're calling it V-Day, Vaccination Day, a term coined by the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. They have already procured 800,000 doses of it, although they have ordered another 40 million, which will be enough to vaccinate a lot of people, like 20 million people. But why 20 million people? Because as we already know by now, is you need two jabs, 21 days apart. You get one now, wait 21 days, you get the second jab, which is referred to as a booster. Most of that 40 million doses will be available until next year, although the government here is saying that 4 million doses should arrive in the country by the end of next month. There are concerns about its safety among members of the public. One prime reason is that the vaccine was developed in 10 months, a process from concept to reality that usually takes years. Some even are saying 10 years. But whether or not it'll have the impact, or are we going to see after effects or symptoms, is just something we're going to have to wait and see. But there are provisions in place where these jabs are being given at some 60 hospitals and hubs where the jabs are being administered in case people develop some kind of symptoms or suffer from after effects at this point. But as I say, it's something we're going to have to wait and see. There have been calls on the Prime Minister himself, on the Health Secretary himself, to take the jab ahead of other people, but they have said that they are much too young, they are healthy, and then that they didn't want to jump the queue. So what they're doing now is they're administering it to people over 80 years of age, as well as some of their carers and some of the NHS staff. Previously, we also heard that care home residents were also top of the priority list. They still are, but the ones that I mentioned earlier will be the ones that will receive the jab first. And of the over 80s, people, for example, who are being admitted into hospitals or being discharged, or top of the priority list, they will be taking the jab, either going into the hospital or leaving it. So it's going to take several weeks, according to the health secretary, for this to happen, to get the first group of health workers, care staff, and over 80s vaccinated. Those are the words of the health secretary, who has also said that we have a long march ahead of us. So this is something that's going to take a long time to complete, Kaveh. But at the same time as they are administering this vaccine, they're also cautioning people. They are telling people to continue to stick to the rules, just as they have over the past months, to prevent the disease from spreading fast and for the so-called R rate to go up again. And the consequences of that. One of the biggest challenges right now is how they are going to convince people, to discourage people, in other words, especially young people who might think, you know what, we have the cure now, it's back to normal now, and probably start mingling together, or go out shopping, especially because now, in the run-up to the holiday season here in the Western world, in the UK, where we are.
All right. The question still remains, Said. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to ask this again. We understand the part that you get the vaccine and then you have to wait a few weeks, 21 days, I think is what you said, and then you get the second dose. How long does it take before we can see whether the vaccine is working or not? And what is it that we should see or anticipate in terms of what the vaccine is going to do? Because it's one thing to have prevention, if this vaccine does that. It's another thing for people who have symptoms to have them be cured. So I'm looking at the time frame here. That's a big question mark to see if it's successful or not.
That, I think, is the $64 million question. Let's remember that Pfizer and BioNTech, who developed this vaccine, have said that it has a 95% efficacy. So you have that 5% margin still there as to whether or not it'll actually prevent people from coming down with the virus. About those two doses, you get the main dose first that will, according to what the developers of the vaccine say, and it has been approved by the UK, will prevent you from coming down with it. And what it does is going to induce some kind of an immune response from the individual receiving it to the virus. And the second jab, as I said, 21 days apart, will act as a booster in case the effects of the first vaccine wear off. That's my understanding of it. And I think if people were to show any symptoms, it would come either in the 4 weeks, in the 21 days before they get the second jab, or probably afterwards. So we're going to have to wait and see. But again, obviously, the developers have had three stages of trials for the vaccine. They have tested them on volunteers under control or population that they had at their disposal to test the vaccine on, which is why they came out and said it had a 95% efficacy, which again is why the UK government, the medical world here, has approved of it and is now rolling it out, immunizing the most vulnerable over 80s, and in the coming months and probably years, the rest of the population.
Okay, very good. We appreciate it. Thank you very much for that. Syed Purasa, correspondent there from London. Moving on, a New Zealand inquiry into last year's mosque attacks at Christchurch has criticized authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community on rising hate crimes against them. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that a government would act on a proposal for the police to better identify, record, and respond to hate crimes. Ardern admitted that spy agencies failed to focus enough on the threat from far-right terrorists in the run-up to the Christchurch attack. In response to the inquiry, the Muslim Association of Canterbury, where the attack took place, called for an end to state agencies' bias against Muslims.
We've known for a long time that the Muslim community has been unfairly targeted with hate speech and hate crimes. This report shows that we were right. The report shows that institutional prejudice and unconscious bias exists in the government agencies and that needs to change.
The attacks saw a gunman open fire at two mosques in Christchurch in mid-March last year. The white supremacists shot at worshippers, including women and children, during Friday prayers. 51 people were killed as a result. Abdul Razak is the chairman of the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand. He says while New Zealand society is welcoming toward Muslims, they face a challenge over the state body's anti-Muslim bias.
The Federation, the FIANS, we produced a report, which was what's called the seminal report by the Royal Commission. In that report, after 7 months of investigation, we found significant anomalies in the way the gun licensing law was applied, whereby this person, this terrorist, was able to get hold of a gun. The New Zealand specification is that a person has to be vetted and the reference has to be given by a family member. Instead, the New Zealand police relied on two gaming friends online, which is totally beyond the scope of the New Zealand regulations. And for that, the police commissioner apologized today officially. So as far as New Zealand society is concerned, they're very welcoming of Muslims. They're very receptive to diversity. They can be more so, and that's what this whole report was all about. However, there has been institutional bias and institutional Islamophobia and what we call securitization of Islam. These are the challenges facing some of the structures within the country, particularly in the public service, and these are the ones which this Royal Commission addressed, and inshallah there will be some significant positive changes in that direction.
Independent China strategist Andrew Long says that the U.S. arms sales to Taiwan are part of its policy to push back against China.
Of course, this is supported by the Taiwan Relations Act in the United States, under which the United States government is empowered to strengthen China's Taiwan defenses against perceived kind of threats from the mainland. So I think that this is likely to be a new normal, because Taiwan is regarded by the United States is an unsinkable aircraft carrier to push back against China's perceived acts of coercion, for example, in the Taiwan Strait. So I think that we can expect this to continue. In Beijing, there is already a national law enacted a number of years ago preventing this from happening and backing up against this law against separatism or open declaration of independence, some military deployment of missiles, aircraft carriers, and naval forces. So Taiwan knows it. There is no match in this military strength of Taiwan compared with China. The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope. Is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Indian farmers have staged a one-day nationwide strike as part of their efforts to make the government repeal its new agricultural laws. Farmers have pledged to block major roads and rail lines across India for several hours. The government has boosted security across the country. Tens of thousands of farmers have already been camped on the outskirts of the capital since November 27 to protest the laws. The legislation opens up trade in agricultural produce. Farmers say that it will help major firms take over the agriculture industry and force down prices. The Indian government argues that the changes are needed for the future of the industry. Several rounds of talks have failed to narrow differences between the two sides. Earlier we spoke to Harsh Mander, who is the director of the Center for Equity Studies. He said that India's agriculture is in crisis, and the government's new reforms are worsening the situation.
Indian agriculture has been in a very intense crisis for at least 20 years. Now we have literally hundreds of thousands of farmers who are committing suicide. The whole technological, ecological, marketing, everything is in a crisis, and the large majority of farmers are small and marginal farmers. But what there have been a number of commissions which have said that basically farming is no longer an economically viable activity, and it needs significant amounts of support from the state. And that is what they were expecting and hoping, particularly after the lockdown and the level of distress that existed. Instead, what these three laws have done, and they passed them firstly as ordinances even without debate, is largely opening up agriculture suddenly to big multinational corporations who would then control what people would, what farmers would produce, what prices they would be paid. Because today there's a monopoly of the state actually purchasing these producers and having a baseline price.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper, and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barak UK, and has been coordinating solidarity, aid, and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of 3-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen, and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larsen himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across. And it's quite a humanizing way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. You know, at 3, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, yeah. About the style of the filmmaking, because the Larsen does use low-angle steadicam shots, yeah. Mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director, Larsen, was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops, been given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden. And that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa, you know.
That was a really endearing moment. Yeah, I think it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child. But I also think that in some places, you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps? That we don't know where they are, what's happening.
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen. You know, this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to, you know, come to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically. And so this is a different way of getting the message across. And poignantly, and with this three-year-old girl, and she is very similar. I mean, she's gorgeous to look at, and very sweet, and very cute, and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister, and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop, and the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, what kind of conditions are they enduring, and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea, and effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais with both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags, if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne workshops. Is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, for the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously a long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Yeah. Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, we do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of give some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
It's an interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to some certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across, to engage people in that discussion and to look at it. It is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
Mm-hmm. And I think Larsen used the child, though, on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world, and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think, to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanise people. You know, you can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people. These are people just like you and like us going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s. And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, you can't, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness. Do you see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean. It's a really good point.
It's you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone. We're supposed to care for each other, and we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So, according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, so home to some 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, what do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family, to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So, yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They are not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw the human story. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness, pain and fear in the eyes of the adults, but they tried to protect the children from that and, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now, we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how in the documentary there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port and then they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what the passage of time, actually. And only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. So that's basically to keep it, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience or part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
And Zita, would you agree with Marie's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. Within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I can hear them speaking and, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film he wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on, this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. They're embracing their children. They're sticking together. And this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the countries?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, as the credits came up at the end of the film, thinking, okay, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees or even migrating, where my family came and migrated to the UK. She will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there, and it's going to be better for us, and it's going to be better equality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia, because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So Marie, would you like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out?
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate
there. And she's three, and she will presumably integrate. But, yeah, it's
perhaps many challenges lie ahead. And
indeed,
we'll just have to.
And it's scary times at the moment, and also after post-Brexit, I have to say. So
it's scary times indeed. And I'm afraid we'll have to end it there, but thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Ali al-Azim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyatillahi fil arabin ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarih. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafsa ammara, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and Mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لقد أرسلنا رسلنا بالبينات وأنزلنا معهم الكتاب والميزان ليقوم الناس بالقسط. So, what we inshallah have to do is first to understand what was the idea of that universal community and what are the requirements for belonging to that community, and the third, the mechanism of making that community happen. If we just sit, nothing is going to happen. It can go on for thousands of years and nothing happens. But we can work hard and make it happen next year or maybe next month. It's up to us. So we have to see what is that community, what are the characteristics, and how can we prepare ourselves for that, and how can we make it happen. Tonight I mention some verses of the Quran about the fact that, first of all, this is certainly going to happen. It's just a matter of time and which generation is going to have the honor. Otherwise, this is going to happen. No one should think that they can stop this. No one can stop the plan that Allah has made. Allah has made this plan very clear in the Quran, in many places. Not only those verses which talk about the mission of Imam Mahdi, like وَنُرِيدُ أَنَّ مُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ. But also the verses which talk about the message of Islam in itself. For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in three places says, هُوَ الَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينَ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينَ كُلِّهِ. This is mentioned in the Quran in three places. In two places, the ending is وَلَوْ كَرَهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ, which is Surah Tawbah, verse 33, and Surah Saf, verse 9. هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون. And in Surah Fath, verse 28, the ending is different. هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله وكفى بالله الشهيدا.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear.
So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Let us reflect on these three verses. Allah is the one. Huwa alladhi. He is the one that has sent his messenger with guidance. Wadin al-haq. Those who know Arabic, they understand that there is a difference between ad-din al-haq and din al-haq. So this is not adjective, this is muzaf and muzafun ilayh. Wadin al-haq, not ad-din al-haq. Din al-haq means religion of truth, not true religion. Because if you say true religion, then people may, you know, wonder, what is that true religion? This is the religion of truth, means the religion of being truthful. Inshallah, one night I will talk about truthfulness. One of the most important quality of a mu'min and also a Muslim community is to be truthful, to be 100% committed to haq. Otherwise, we cannot claim that we are mu'min. Allah has sent his messenger with guidance and the religion of truth. The path, religion, deen means path. This is the path of truth. Anyone in the world who is interested in truthfulness, who is interested in honesty, will find this religion acceptable. Inshallah, I will explain that there can be people who are not Muslims, but they are truthful and honest. In my understanding, these are closer to Islam than those Muslims who are not honest.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away, please let them be with Muhammad and all Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabb
Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.